Hey there, Sports History fan. Arnie Chapman here from the Sports History Network. Now, before you jump into this episode, I wanted to share with you an exciting giveaway we have going on with Home Field Apparel. We have a digital $50 gift card to homefieldapparel.com for one lucky fan of the Sports History Network. All you got to do is head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways to sign up. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways.
Some of the teams we might not know much history about are from some of those leagues that were only around a few years, like the AAFC. And one of those teams is on the West Coast, the LA Dons. George Bozica joins us today back in the Pigpen to tell us all about the LA Dons in just a moment.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com, and welcome once again to the Pigpen. And we are in our early pro football mode, and we're going to talk about a story today that's truly old Hollywood. I really mean old Hollywood. We're going to be talking about the LA Dons, and George Bozica, the great historian from the Canton, Ohio area, is coming to join us on this story. George Bozica, welcome back to the Pigpen.
Thanks, Darren. Happy to be here again.
George, have you had anything new going on over in Canton since we last talked to you about a month ago or so?
Not really. They're still continuing on with the construction of the village, which is going on, as we speak. Of course, maybe some things shutting down here as we get into the winter months, but they're still active with that. Obviously, we're actively into the high school football season here, and obviously the Browns have gotten off to a good start. So that Northeast Ohio is happy about that.
Yeah, Northeast Ohio is doing well. Southwest Pennsylvania, not so much right now. But different story for another day, right?
Yeah, really, really.
Georgia, we have you on for a very interesting topic, a very interesting team that probably not a lot of people know about, the Los Angeles Dons. And we're hoping maybe you can shed some light on this team for us, like, you know, how they started out and where they went.
Yeah, I really enjoyed, research. I knew a little bit about the Dons. I knew that obviously they were part of the old All-America Football Conference. And I knew they obviously had some Hollywood ties. But it found it to be a really fascinating story. During the war, World War II, obviously, but during the war, the NFL was receiving, some applications for some possible prospective, new teams. And they had received some applications from, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Buffalo were the three main ones. And as it turned out, they decided to put it on hold until after the war was over. But the LA group was headed by the actor Don Ameche. I think most of us know, Don Ameche was a fairly big star back in the day with 20th Century Fox, a part of their stable with Tyrone Power and some other, great actors back then. But I think a modern audience probably remembers him more from his Academy Award winning performance in Cocoon, and even more famously trading places with Eddie Murphy and Dan Aykroyd, where he played one of the Duke brothers. So I think that's how we mostly remember Don Ameche. But I think the thing that interested me was, is that I didn't realize how actively involved in sports that he was. He was really a sportsman. He headed the group that was really anxious to have a team in Los Angeles back then. But one of the big issues back then, and I know that's sort of maybe hard to understand now, was travel. They did not have the kind of travel that we have today back, before the war. And, because of that, there was always concern about expansion to the West Coast, because most travel back then was by train. So, there was always that, concern with pro football. A person by the name of Arch Ward, who was a Chicago Tribune sports editor, and Arch Ward is really a quite a mover and shaker in the sports world back in the day. He was the person that started the Major League Baseball All-Star Game. He started the Golden Gloves. He started the College All-Star Game. And he was at one time even offered the job of football commissioner, NFL commissioner. Arch Ward was good friends with Don Ameche. And so he sort of argued on his behalf. But as I said, he was turned down and things were tabled. And that just really upset and sort of basically made Ward livid. So Arch Ward turned around and started the All-America Football Conference. And so he was a mover and shaker that actually started the conference. He felt at the time that, you know, if you had an American League and a National League in Major League Baseball, why couldn't you have two leagues in pro football, you know, the All-America Conference and the National Football League? So that was his feeling. And actually, he envisioned sort of almost like a World Series of football to be played at one point. So that was sort of his vision, that's what I think he was hoping would eventually happen. At any rate, he started a league, and one of the teams, the Los Angeles team, was basically the ownership interests were awarded to Don Ameche and Christy Walsh. Christy Walsh is also an interesting person. He was a sports agent, and he was the person that represented Babe Ruth, Ty Cobb, and Lou Gehrig. So Christy Walsh had that background. Well, Christy Walsh was involved in the Los Angeles franchise in the All-American Conference for a short period of time, and then basically dropped out. At that point, then there was basically a pretty heady ownership group. And this Los Angeles franchise obviously became the Los Angeles Dons, just so we tie all that up. And they had a very heady ownership group. In addition to Don Ameche, who was basically became president of the club, some of the other movers and shakers were Ben Linhammer. Ben Linhammer was a businessman and a racetrack owner. And then you sort of had a who's who of Hollywood. You had Louis B. Mayer, who was the head of MGM Studios, one of probably the most powerful men in Hollywood at that time. You had Bob Hope.
Wow.
We all know Bob Hope. You had Bing Crosby. We all know Bing Crosby. And Pat O'Brien. Pat O'Brien was actually with Warner Brothers. He was one of their stable. But Pat O'Brien obviously famously played Newt Rockne and Newt Rockne All-American. In researching newspaper articles from the time, there it's interesting to me because there was also some other names of Hollywood stars that supposedly had some interest in the Dons too. One that came up that really sort of shocked me was Clark Gable. Gable's name was mentioned in a column that I read about the Dons. I also saw a name like Kerry James, a famous big band trumpeter. So he was mentioned. So you had this sort of, you know, who's who of Hollywood that was, you know, part of this ownership group for the Los Angeles Dons. And basically, as they got the franchise and the new conference, which would start play in 1946, they named their GM, and his name was Edward Slip Madigan. And Slip Madigan had actually played for Rockne at Notre Dame. And he was a longtime coach at St. Mary's, which is a university college in California. And he was sort of a flashy, flamboyant type. The head coach was Dudley Dud DeGroot. He was a college coach, and actually he had NFL experience. He had been the head coach of the Washington, then obviously Redskins, now the Washington football team, in 44 and 45. And actually, this is part of the irony of the situation. He had coached the Redskins in the NFL championship game in 1945. And lo and behold, the Redskins lost that game 15-14 to the Cleveland Rams. So let's remember that the Cleveland Rams, the very next year, moved to Los Angeles. So in 1946, you now in an area that had never had a pro team that was actually based in Los Angeles, because in the past, when there had been Los Angeles teams, they had always been travel teams. They actually were never based in Los Angeles. So now all of a sudden in 1946, you had the Cleveland Rams, who became the Los Angeles Rams, owned by Dan Reeves. And you had this new Los Angeles Dons owned by this Hollywood ownership group now in the City of Angels. Reeves Rams had won, as I said, the championship in Cleveland in 45, but he was losing money. And Reeves was very wealthy. He was part of a grocery chain magnet group that basically, so he was also moneyed. And he viewed the West Coast as a promised land. He had always been impressed with the West Coast and thought it was like, you know, go West, young man. So, he wanted to take his team West, and he was finally able to do that. So now you have two teams in Los Angeles, and both of them wanted to play in the Coliseum, the Memorial Coliseum. The Coliseum at that time had sort of an unofficial ban against pro teams because it was basically, used for the college teams at that time, USC and the other, universities in the area. So they both, Reeves wanted to play there and also the Dons wanted to play there. So they had to go before the Coliseum Commission, which would make the decision as to whether, pro teams would be able to play in the Coliseum, because, at that time, the Coliseum, over 100,000 people, they said, this is a great match to be able to have, that kind of, facility. So right. What the commission did is they were very excited about the Rams. I think the Rams' background being the NFL champs the year before and everything else, plus they were a member of the already existing NFL. In looking at the newspaper articles of the time, it appeared that the commission really wanted the Rams. But what happened at this point is, let's remember that at that point, the league was in a period of time when African-American players were not playing football. There was sort of an unofficial, ban on them in the league at that time. And Haley Harding, who was an influential Black sports writer in the Los Angeles area, plus a number of other Black sports writers, went to the commission and voiced the opinion that, because it was publicly owned and financed, that if there was going to be a team play there, a pro team play there, they needed to integrate. And the Rams basically committed that they would integrate. And basically then they signed Kenny Washington and Woody Strode, which started in 1946, the reintegration of the NFL. Actually, in Canton, and I know you visited Canton this summer for our convention, they have what's called in downtown Canton the 11, which are 11 key moments in NFL history where they have murals or art pieces. And one of those is for the reintegration of the NFL. And they have depictions there of Woody Strode and also of Kenny Washington, plus the Browns, who also became a member of the All-America Conference. The Cleveland Browns also signed Mary and Molly and Bill Willis. But I digress.
Let's just reflect on this for a second. Sure. Okay. We have NFL champions, the reigning champions,
right,
coming out. And they're, so you got a great football group there. And mm-hmm. now they've brought in two players from UCLA,
right.
that great backfield. I believe they called them the golden backfield, I think, for UCLA that year. Mm-hmm. I think Jackie Robinson
also played at UCLA. Yes.
Yeah. So, and that was pretty great, good integration for African-Americans at the college level,
right.
just a year or two before that, or
right.
years prior to that. So right. you have that group. And now you have with the Dons, you have the Hollywood A-list of actors, mm-hmm. and you have, big owners with, or some big people in Metro Golden Mayer, founder, and some major musicians and mm-hmm. some other celebrities heading that. That's got to be pretty torn for a public that's starving for football. I mean, they're getting like from feast to famine. Mm-hmm. But that's got to be a hard decision on who you want to support there.
Well, one of the interesting things is that the commission was really gung-ho about the Rams. They were, the Dons also wanted to play at the Coliseum. They were less gung-ho about the Dons. And sort of a sports writer back then for the Los Angeles Times, Vincent X. Flaherty, who was, a fairly well-known columnist at the time, he really took the commission to task, because one of the reasons that the commission gave was, well, they weren't sure if the Dons had enough money. Now, you're talking about, Louis B. Mayer, who owned Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, which was, it was probably the major studio then. I mean, that was during the time of the studio system. And you had these very powerful studio heads. You had Louis B. Mayer at MGM, Daryl Zanuck at 20th Century Fox. You had the Warners that had Warner Brothers, and you also had, Paramount. So you had these studios that were, basically these great movers and shakers in Hollywood and Los Angeles area. And, and then plus you had Bing Crosby and Bob Hope and, these, major stars who also, had the wealth, and, they're worried about the money, and then, whereas, but eventually you know, the Dons also made a commitment regarding, you know, African-American players. So the Dons also got the dates that they wanted, you know, at the Coliseum. And actually, interestingly enough, the Dons played their first game at the Coliseum 16 days before the Rams did. So they actually played the first game in the Coliseum on September 13th of 46. They played the Brooklyn Dodgers of the All-America Football Conference. And they won 20-14 before just under 19,000 people, 18,995 people. So they actually played the first game at the Coliseum even before the Rams did. The first regular season game. So, you know, they had that. There had been also some exhibition games, but that was the first regular season game played between the Rams and the Dons. So the Dons did have sort of that claim. Is that they did get to play the first regular season game there. So
isn't that interesting that a foreshadowing a team called the Brooklyn Dodgers is playing for the first games of the AFC out there, you know, for what would happen in baseball a few years later. Very interesting.
Yeah. So one of the things that the Dons felt is that even though they made a lot of the fact that they had this great ownership group, you know, they felt that they did need some stars. You know, the Rams had, you know, Bob Waterfield, who I believe we talked about previously, that, you know, he was married to Jane Russell, who was a huge, you know, sex symbol, you know, back at that time. And, you know, she was a big movie star and, you know, they had the star power. And, you know, obviously Dan Reeves, who was the owner of the Rams, understood tying together, you know, the star power with Los Angeles, because that's what Los Angeles was about. So, you know, Slip Madigan realized that he needed to get some stars too. So one of the people he went after was he tried to get Tom Harmon, you know, Tom Harmon, the great University of Michigan player. And Harmon instead wanted to go with the Rams. So then he went after Heisman Trophy winner Angelo Bertelli from Notre Dame. And he actually signed a contract with the Dons for $60,000 or very $10,000 bonus. Well, Bertelli reconsidered because he also signed with the NFL's Boston Yanks. There was actually a franchise in the NFL then called the Boston Yanks. And he returned a bonus, which he said was only $1,000. Well, the Dons got a temporary restraining order and basically that you know, he could only play with the Dons because he already had the existing contract. And Bertelli countersued, the Dons won. So they got Bertelli, the Heisman Trophy winner, to play for them in 1946. And here's an interesting side story about Bertelli. Not only was he the Heisman Trophy winner, but I don't know if you've ever had a discussion on your show about the Atom Bowl.
No.
Also known as the Atomic Bowl. The Atom Bowl, or the Atomic Bowl, it's been known by both, was actually played in Nagasaki, Japan on January 1st, 1946, amongst the ruins of Nagasaki. And it was between two Marine Corps teams, one that was led by Bertelli, and basically it was done to entertain homesick servicemen that were still stationed in that area, you know, after the war and after the atomic bombs were dropped. So it's a fascinating story in and of itself that a game was actually played in Nagasaki, you know, months after the atomic bomb was dropped there.
Yeah, I'm thinking of radioactivity and things like that still present.
That's all part of the extended story of it. It's a fascinating story. It's probably worth a show somewhere in the future, because I said, wow, I had never known about it. And there were some NFL players, future NFL players that you know, and even some, I believe, existed. Seen NFL players that played in the game, so it's a fascinating sort of piece of football history and service football history, you know, back at that time. But it was just really fascinating. So they had Bertelli, who obviously being a Heisman Trophy winner was, you know, a star. They didn't actually start signing any African American players until the 47th season, and they actually had three at that time. As Reed Anderson, who is nicknamed Sugarfoot, he was an end and a defensive back for them. He had played for the minor league Hollywood Bears in 45 and 46, and he went on to play actually in the CFL for Calgary in the Canadian League, and he actually is on their Wall of Fame. And then there was two others, Bert Piggott, who played one season, and John Brown, a linebacker center who played 3 years, played 3 years for the Dons. So they did eventually sign some African-American players. Dons did not train in Los Angeles. They trained in Ventura, Ventura is about 65 miles north of Los Angeles. And I saw one newspaper article refer to them as Ventura's adopted sons of the gridiron, which I just love that saying. They had a fairly successful first season. They were in the same Western division with two of the best teams in the All-America Football Conference, the Browns and the 49ers. So they always were playing sort of third fiddle to those two teams. Obviously, the Browns, as we all know, dominated the All-America Football Conference. So on a Sunday in October of that year, they traveled to Cleveland, and they were 3-1-1 at the time to take on the Browns. And the Browns were 6-0 at that time before a little over 71,000 at Cleveland Municipal Stadium. And the Browns won fairly handily, 31-14. The 46 Times, Los Angeles Times, actually had an ad for ticket sales for the Dons. And I found this fascinating. It said in large print, "Here come the Dons, nation's greatest football team, world's best football players, 7 games for the price of 6. And get this, you know what the price was for those 7 games for the price of 6? $21.
Oh, wow.
And it gets you, and it gets you at the 50. So not only was it $21 for 7 games, but they said you're going to play sit at the 50-yard line. Can you imagine that today?
I don't even know if you can buy a beer and a hot dog for that price on an NFL game.
Yeah, I don't think so. It's interesting because I saw an article today online, and it referred to the $100 parking lot at SoFi Stadium in Los Angeles, the new stadium in Los Angeles. Just $100 just to park. Just the park.
Yeah. Wow.
So that was just amazing. Another, you know, the ties to Hollywood. On December 1st, the Dons beat the Buffalo Bison 62-14. And at halftime, Lou Costello of Abbott and Costello apparently came up into the press box, and he wanted a charity game to be played between the Rams and the Dons to benefit his youth foundation. So he said to the entire stadium over the PA that the Dons had agreed, but the Rams had not. And he asked fans to bombard the Los Angeles Times to get the Rams to play in this charity game for his youth foundation. Reeves said that it was against NFL rules, and said that Costello, though well-intentioned, had been misled. But Lou, he was a straight man. He was, you know, Bud Abbott and Lou Costello. He was a straight man, but he got up there and, you know, made that announcement. The Dons actually drew really well. They out in their 4 years of existence, they outdrew the Rams 2 of those 4 years.
Really? So, wow.
So they drew well. They billed themselves as America's most colorful football team. And it was interesting because not only was Don Ameche the president, but just based on newspaper articles I saw at the time of that era in the Los Angeles Times, he basically was the face of the organization. You know, it always refers to the fact that Ameche made this announcement or Ameche made that announcement. And actually, I even saw a couple headlines or references in articles that referred to them as the Ameches, or referred to them as the Ameche men. In the local press, Don Ameche was very, you know, actively involved. He wasn't just, you know, a figurehead type of thing. He was very actively involved in the team.
Is that where their nickname did come from? Dons from
Dons? Actually, they say that, you know, I saw two different things. I saw a fight song that was in one of their 46 programs, and I wanted to read it because it seems to indicate it came more from the Spanish word Don, which was like, you know, head of a household or, you know, sort of that type of thing, you know. So I think it was tied more to that. And if I can find in here, I had it marked and I lost my mark, but their fight song at the time, if you listen to the words, it does, you know, play off of that. One of the other things they did while I was finding this is that one of the things that they did to sort of attract fans is that they had a program called Kid Football. And I'm going to get into that in a minute. Here's the fight song. And this is why I think that the nickname actually came from, as I said, the Spanish word Don. It said the name of the fight song is Fight for the Dons. It says, "We'll bring back the golden days of California's gay Don Juans with a gang we are proud of always. Proud sons of California Dons. Now the stories tell that they were devils with the ladies, but when things got tough, they would fight like fiends from Hades. So hail to their gallant sons and fight for our Los Angeles Dons. So okay. that was their fight song. So I think, even though obviously Don Amici Dons, I mean, I think it was, if you look at their logos and stuff like that, that were on their programs, they do play off of that the Spanish word Don, which, like I said, is like a head of the household. So what
was their logo, if you can explain it to us?
It was basically, I saw a couple of different things, but it always played off of the idea of, you know, that sort of Spanish character, with, you know, with sort of a Spanish type of outfit and everything else. So
like a conquistador type helmet.
Yeah. Sort of like in along those lines. Yeah. Their colors were blue and red. So they played off of that. And I actually had some of their programs in my collection, and I picked up a couple others to sort of prepare for this. And they had just had some great, you know, graphics. The programs were just so much better back then. Now, you know, we've sort of gotten away from some of that great art that was on the programs back then, that was really sort of, of that time frame. But they had this thing called Kid Football, and it started in 1947. It didn't start their first year. And as these games were played at halftime, and again, the Hollywood tie here again, four Hollywood stars sponsored these kid football teams. And the kid football teams, they actually sponsored the uniforms. And the games were played during halftime of the games on a 60-yard field with league rules. And there were four teams. There was Al Jolson had a team called the Sunny Boys. Bob Hope had a team called the Junior Dons. Jimmy Durante had a team called the Schnozzolas. And Mickey Rooney had a team, the Fighting Irish. And the winner of the Kid League got the Don Amici Trophy. The winner also got a gold football. Second place got a silver football. So I thought it was interesting. If you look in the program, they even had the schedule of the kids' football, and they had pictures of the four stars and all that. Interestingly enough, Bob Hope was listed in a number of places I saw as part of the ownership group. He also became part of the ownership group of the Rams. Also, he had an interest in the Rams too. So again, he was another person that, you know, had a lot of interest. I know from reading in the past that because he was from the Cleveland area, he had an interest in the Indians for a number of years. And Bing Crosby and him, obviously, we all know about their golf tournaments over the years. So they obviously were both avid golfers. Bing Crosby at one time had an interest in the Pittsburgh Pirates. So, you know, a lot of these Hollywood stars had these, you know, sporting interests, including, you know, obviously Don Amici. So I thought it was just interesting, the tie between sports and Hollywood, you know, that, you know, but these guys had the money to be able to do those kind of things too. So, you know, they were making, you know, more money than, you know, the average citizen, obviously. So they were able to do that kind of stuff.
Making a lot more than the professional athletes that they were owning at that time.
Probably too. At the time. Yeah. You know, now that's probably not so true because it's all part of an entertainment business, obviously. But I mean, you know, when you consider what athletes make these days, but yeah, you know, back then, and that was one of the interesting things about the All-America Conference too, is that a lot of the owners were people that were sort of millionaires based on other areas. They hadn't made their money necessarily in sports. You know, you had obviously Amici and Louis B. Mayer that were in the movies. Mickey McBride, who was one of the owners of the Browns, he was a big taxi cab sort of owner in the Cleveland area. So, you know, you had these sort of money people that had money, whereas they sort of distinguish that from some of the NFL owners that, you know, a lot of the NFL owners and people that were heading up the teams actually did get their start in, you know, football, like George Halas and the Bears, for example. So, you know, so it was sort of a differentiation of what the AAFC, you know, brought to the table. So,
yeah. I mean, what a brilliant bit of marketing by the Dons to really, I mean, they're already ingrained in that area because of their star power, but then to take, you know, some of those stars, you know, the Jolson, Hope, and some of the others, and, you know, invest in these kids teams. So now you've got those kids vested in the Dons program and their games and their parents and their neighborhoods. I mean, exactly. Just brilliant. Brilliant. Now, that's probably why they were outdrawing the Rams at that time.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it was great marketing because that way you got, you know, people involved, and, you know, the ticket price, obviously you couldn't beat that ticket price. Although I'm sure $350 per game back then, you know, was probably, you know, a major outlay back then was what people were probably making back then. You know, I remember my dad saying he went to the movie theater for 5-10 cents back then. You know, it's just so much different than the pricing that, you know, obviously we're used to now, where you, you know, spend so much money to go to a pro football game. You know, it just was a different world, you know, so.
Right. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, interesting.
So as I said, the Dons always had this situation too, where they were in this Western division. They finished 7-7 in their second season in 1947 behind Cleveland and San Francisco. Dud DeGroot, their coach, basically stepped away after 11 games, resigned, and they were co-coached for their last three games by Mel Hine, who became a Hall of Famer, and Ted Shipley. Obviously, the NFL was playing a 12-game schedule at the time. The Dons and the AFC were playing a 14-game schedule already. So that was another differentiation. On September 12th of 47, they drew 82,675 people to the Coliseum, then considered a pro record for a game with the New York Yankees football team. You know, we talked about the Brooklyn Dodgers. There was also a New York Yankees football team in the old AAFC, and they lost that game 30-14. There was rumors. This was a hot rumor that I saw in the papers at the time as to who was their next coach going to be. Some people thought it was going to be Clark Shaughnessy, the sort of great football mind. Some people thought it was going to be Frank Leahy, Notre Dame. Some thought it was going to be Fritz Kreisler, Michigan. So there was a lot of names that were bandied about. But finally, in 48, they hired Jim Phelan, who had been had some success at the college level. He also had been at St. Mary's. And his other sort of dubious claim to fame is he coached the Dallas Texans NFL team in 1952 that went 1-11. And the only game they won, that team had Art Donovan on it and, you know, some others who later ended up playing for the NFL champion Colts in 58 and 59. But their only game they won that year was a Thanksgiving Day game at the Rubber Bowl in Akron, Ohio, where I live. And they beat the Chicago Bears before a really sparse crowd. One of the players said that the crowd was so small, the players could have gone up into the stands and shook the hand of every guy that was the person that was at the game that day. So that was sort of what he ended up. So, with Phelan as a coach, they again finished 7-7 in 48, again behind Cleveland and San Francisco, because they were just sort of doomed because of, you know, being behind two of the best teams in the AAFC. That was always something that sort of doomed the franchise because they were in that, you know, difficult Western division with those two teams. By 1949, the league only had seven teams. It was starting to, because of salary wars with the NFL, you know, it was starting to, you know, sort of come apart at the seams. The Dons finished fifth that year in that seven-team league with a 4-8 record. That was their worst season of the four that they had. The great Hall of Famer Dutch Clark, who played for the Lions, was their backfield coach that season. Of course, at the end of the 49 season, the AAFC merged with the NFL, and the Dons were disbanded. There was some talk at the time that the Dons and the Rams may merge, but it never came to be. So in their 4 years of existence, the Dons were not a bad team. They were basically a mediocre team. They finished 25-27-2 over the 4 years. But one of the interesting things is that the Browns only lost four games during their AAFC existence. They lost two games to the 49ers, who we've already mentioned was one of the better teams in the league. They lost two games to the Dons. So the Dons were not a bad team. They were just in a very, you know, tough division, having to play those teams, you know, year in and year out. But, you know, they held their own. You know, they beat the Browns twice, and those are two of the only losses the Browns had in the whole history, you know, of the league. So I found that interesting that, you know, here's a team that went into the NFL and basically, you know, played in, you know, consecutive NFL championship games for like, you know, from 50, I think, to 56. And, you know, the Los Angeles Dons held their own, you know.
At the height of the AFC, how many teams were in the AFC?
I know that there were seven that final season.
I'm just trying to get a picture of how many times maybe they would have been playing per season. Probably at least twice, I would guess.
Yeah,
I'm talking the Dons and the Browns.
Right. I want to say it was either 10 teams or 12 teams. And I'm sort of consulting while I'm talking here, my AAFC sort of encyclopedia to see, okay. Let's see. In 46, there were 8 teams. There were the Yankees, the Dodgers, they refer to them as the Bills. I've also seen them referred to as the Bisons, the Seahawks, which were in Miami, and they only lasted that one season. The Browns, the Niners, the Dons, and the Rockets. And then the second year, the Colts, the Baltimore Colts took over for the Seahawks, and you had the same 4 teams in the West. The third year, the Bills, the Colts, the Yankees, and the Dodgers in the East, and the same 4, the Browns, the Niners, the Dons, and the Rockets in the West. And then their last season, the 49, the 7 teams are the Browns, the Niners. Brooklyn and New York merged to become a joint team, Brooklyn, New York, the Bills, the Hornets, the Dons, and the Colts. I think I referred to the Bills as the Bisons because I've also saw them referred to as the Bisons in some articles during that first season, but the encyclopedia shows them as the Bills.
So that's still a pretty good thing for such a powerhouse of the Cleveland Browns were in especially in the AAFC to beat them, basically at least one out of, two times out of 16, let's say at least.
Right.
So that's phenomenal.
So they definitely had some luck against the Browns over those 4 years.
What do you attribute maybe that they didn't have besides the maybe that's the whole thing, the Browns are just such a powerhouse and were so well coached, but is that the only reason you think why the Dons didn't have a better record and maybe it would have become maybe a fourth team that the NFL would have merged?
I think there was a couple of things. I don't think that the Dons were on the same talent level as the Browns. I think that you know people felt that Paul Brown was such an organized person that, I've read things that said that, he was sort of scouting players in hopes that he would eventually have his own, pro football team. So as he was coaching at Ohio State, and then he was coaching at Great Lakes during during that time frame, he was becoming aware of players. And then those players like Otto Graham from Northwestern and Mary Molly and those, he remembered these guys, and then when he had the team, he invited these, players to play on his team. And so, I think he was doing that. So, he did a really good job in terms of putting that talent together. I just don't think that the Dons, in comparison to the Browns, well, in comparison to a lot of the teams, just didn't have the same talent level that the Browns did. And then I think that it probably hurt the Dons that, you had the Rams, and I just think that they were, probably just a little bit, more established. Their attendance was better that last season. And even though there was talk about, merging the two teams, it just, never happened. Not that the Rams obviously were an immediate success in Los Angeles, but, they were starting to turn the corner there, towards the end of the decade, and they started, having some teams that did play, in the NFL, championship games, because they played in 49, they played in 50, they played in 51, and then they played again in 55. So you had that sort of nucleus from the Rams team also.
Yeah. I wonder if maybe part of it was just by your description of sort of the hierarchy of the Dons that they didn't have enough football people in that hierarchy. I understand they had the coach and a general manager.
Right.
But, almost comparatively to, the first 2 times that the XFL tried to come in, they were, more from the wrestling entertainment background and tried to come into the world of football, and the football heads around just didn't accept it for that, even though they might have had some great marketing ideas and tried to do some things from the other entertainment industries, maybe just didn't work out. But maybe that had some merit to it also.
I think that could have been part of it also. I guess we can sort of hypothesize, but obviously I don't think there was ever any doubt that the Browns were run by Paul Brown. Even though Mickey McBride was the owner, I mean, Paul Brown was running, everything. Whereas I see obviously the Dons had Slip Madigan as their general manager. But like I said, when I would see articles, I would see Don Ameche just seemed to be front and center. Don Ameche announced this, John Ameche announced that. So, I mean, I think he was, pretty actively involved. He just, obviously he had a successful film career at that time too, because, you know, if you Google his name at the time and you read newspaper articles, it's either going to come up with some movie release that he had, or it's going to be about the Dons, or it was about, he also, I believe, owned a racehorse. So, you know, so I mean, you know, he obviously had an interest in sort of a, you know, the sporting life. So, you know, so.
Yeah. I think just the stars that were owning that team, you covered probably just about every major movie, you know, right post World War II, you know, when you have Bing Crosby and Bob Hope and Amici and Clark Gable, you know, you're mentioning that's quite a bit of a Hollywood A-list there.
It was definitely a lot of star power. And, you know, even some of the people that were involved in the kids' football games, you had Bob Hope, you know, Jimmy Durante was a fairly big star at the time. Mickey Rooney, you know, I think people remember Mickey Rooney, you know, later in his career, but I mean, in the 40s, you know, he was as big a star as there was at MGM back then. You know, I mean, I think we remember him from Andy Hardy and all that, but he was really a good, even serious actor. And I remember one time, you know, Laurence Olivier, you know, who's always, you know, considered one of the great actors of all time, Shakespearean actors of all time, you know, he praised Mickey Rooney's talent, like, you know, just about how talented Mickey Rooney was. And, you know, Al Jolson obviously was a great sort of, I guess you would say, cabaret or nightclub singer at the time, although his act today with the blackface and everything obviously wouldn't be politically correct today, but, you know, back then, you know, obviously he was a very successful, you know, nightclub and cabaret singer.
It's a tremendous story. It's hard for us in this world of Hollywood and, you know, football, because the two paths really don't cross all that much. We had football players that go on into acting, but you'd never really have the crossover of ownership of big stars owning, you know, at least NFL teams. And so that's very interesting, very compelling story. So appreciate you sharing that with us.
Yeah. The one other thing I wanted to cover is who some of their better players were. Len Ford was a defensive end that played for them for a couple seasons, and he later went on to play for the Browns, and he was a member of the 50s All-Decade team and actually was inducted into the Hall of Fame. So Len Ford, he was also, oddly enough, he was mostly known for his defensive prowess, but he also was a receiver for the Don for a couple seasons, actually caught 67 balls for 1,175 yards and 8 touchdowns. And then there was Glenn Dobbs, who was one of the better passer punters in the AAFC. And he played for the Dons for 3 seasons. He went on to star in the CFL for the Saskatchewan franchise. And actually, he was really popular up there, his name being Glenn Dobbs. I read that they sold Dobber shirts, Dobber jeans, and Dobberville license plates. So he was quite popular. He was quite popular up there. And then two other, you know, successful players they had. Bob Nelson was a center. He was sort of a perennial all AAFC center. And also Bob Reinhardt, a tackle from 46 to 49. He was also perennial all AAFC. And he actually played for the Rams in 1950. And then another name, which I think some people remember as one of the better kickers of that era, Ben Agajanian, and he played for the Dons for a couple of seasons back then. He was obviously the traditional straight on kicker, and I think obviously the most famous kicker to come out of the AAFC would be Lou Groza with the Browns. But Ben Agajanian was a very good kicker, you know, back at that time, and had a long career with a number of different teams. So they were some of the better players that the Dons had, you know, during that time frame. And one of the articles I read said, you know, some of the former players of the Dons, it was a Los Angeles Times article from many years after the Dons. And they said, we played good football in the AAFC. You know, I think that, you know, the Browns went on and had a lot of success. They were always considered not, you know, as good a league as the NFL at the time. But, you know, when you look at the success that, you know, the Browns had and everything, you know, they did have some great players that started in the AAFC, ended up in the NFL, and a number of them that went on to be Hall of Famers and got their start. The one that comes to my mind immediately because of just having done the book on the 51 Rams was Crazy Legs Hirsch. He played in the with the Chicago franchise in the AAFC. So he was just another one that, you know, went on. You did have these players that started in the league and went on to success. And there's others. He was the one that just came to mind immediately to me, but there's others also. So,
well, you mean yeah, like you said, you had Paul Brown playing against Lem Ford when he was playing for the Dons, you know, brought him onto the Browns team coming in the NFL.
He did.
I think we talked about that when we were doing the football by numbers that you were on.
Yes.
He was talking about that. So yeah, very interesting. Very good story.
Yeah. So that's sort of the story of the, as they build themselves, America's most colorful football team. So in fact, I have a program here that I was reading that, and that's what the top of the program says in large print at the top: America's most colorful football team, and it's one of the most colorful football programs I've seen. There's one I saw that basically had all the color palettes on the program, and they had a player in each palette, and it matched up with whatever their college team was. So but you know, again, it goes back to what you said: they had some unique marketing, you know, and I think they, you know, they played off of that. Maybe the fact that they did have these, you know, movie people, you know, didn't hurt. You know, so they did that.
They definitely win the record for probably the most celebrity power of any ownership group I've ever heard of in any sport, I think, any professional team. So, fantastic.
Yeah.
But George, I appreciate you so much for doing that research and sharing it with us to learn about this exciting team from the late 1940s in the AAFC. Can't thank you enough, my friend. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Hey, are you ready for some football? Some fantasy football? How about some daily fantasy football? Silly questions, right? Of course you are. You're ready to talk some smack and win some cash every Sunday and Thursday and Monday and whenever there's football games. The Sports History Network invites you to play your daily fantasy football this season at ThriveFantasy.com. Thrive Fantasy offers hundreds of thousands, millions in cash every day on NBA, MLB, PGA, golf, cricket, esports, and of course, NFL football. Every week during the 2021 NFL season, Thrive Fantasy has pool play contests and heads-up matches with prizes of all sizes, and even free play contests for real money. Sign up with Thrive Fantasy today to get a 100% match bonus on your first deposit for up to $100 in free daily fantasy football play. Visit sportshistorynetwork.com/thrive. That's THRIVE. Or enter promo code SHN when depositing at the cashier. Join Thrive Fantasy today, earn cash prizes, and support great shows like this at the Sports History Network. Now that's a win-win-win situation for you to kick off your own NFL season.
Peeking up at the clock, the time's running down. We're going to go into victory formation, take a knee, and let this baby run out. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you back tomorrow for the next podcast.
We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Do you wish you knew more about the 100 seasons of the NFL? You're in luck because you found the Football History Dude podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. From the founding of the league in an auto showroom, all the way to what it is today, America's favorite sport and a behemoth of an industry. My name is Ernie Chapman. Football is my passion, and I want you to come along with me each week to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board my DeLorean and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.